selfish, more determined to get my own way in a material sense, having lost, through obedience to others' dictates, the spiritual and mental comfort I once possessed. A period of great trouble came upon my family at this time. My grandfather passed over. And on his will being read, it was revealed that he had not nearly so much money as his successors thought, having spent a great deal in his lifetime, not always wisely, I am afraid, and that he had cut his two sons, my father and uncle, entirely out of his will. This was a blow, as though both sons were clever in many ways, they had pursued their different vocations more in an amateur status than a professional, or even serious sense, and had been living up to the hilt with the promise of money to come on their father's death. The position of the two brothers was hopeless, that is, to men of their upbringing and temperaments. My uncle promptly committed suicide by throwing himself from the fourth-story window of the flat in which he lived. His wife took prussic acid within a few months, and my father seemed to become, for a time, mentally unbalanced and without any sense of responsibility whatever. Our yacht, home, and furniture were sold up, even to the children's toys, and we left the neighborhood and tried to lose ourselves in what seemed to us the absolute squalor of a new condition of things. My father's erratic behavior made it impossible for us to remain with him. We left him, and then began a struggle for existence for my mother and her four children, who had now to live upon the very small allowance made to us by long-suffering relatives of mothers, whose patience must have been sorely tried at times by the inability of anyone of us to do anything practical in order to help ourselves. Not our fault entirely, but their fault of upbringing and environment, and the absence of anything in the way of preparation for such a catastrophe as had befallen us. Chapter 4, A Revelation. While I was in my early teens, my guides made several attempts at various times to draw my attention to spiritualism, in the hope that I should be able to understand and use the psychic power that they knew I possessed. One day I went on a shopping expedition for my mother, and was walking through a congested, busy street, in a north country town, a few miles distant from our home. On my way to the place where I intended to take an omnibus, I happened to glance down a narrow side street, and saw a board displayed outside a rather shabby building, on which were the words, "Spiritualism meetings held at 7 p.m. every Thursday." The actual words conveyed nothing to me, but as I paused and read them, a conviction came that I must attend one of the meetings. That very day was a Thursday, so I went home as quickly as possible, but some instinct told me to say nothing about my project. I am afraid I was very deceitful, as I pretended I was tired, and would go to bed after tea. Mother was going out for the evening till very late, and one thing and another conspired to make everything easy for me, and as soon as I possibly could, I dressed and again went forth to the place where I had seen the notice. I had a curious feeling that I was embarking on a particularly thrilling adventure, an adventure that would prove to be of some importance to me. When I arrived at their building, I found myself going up a badly lit passage, up some uncarpeted stairs, and into a large room where already, though it wanted 20 minutes to the starting time, 60 or 70 people had gathered. Most of them seemed to be of the superior working class, though there was a smattering of men, and women, who might have been anything, judging by their keen, intellectual faces. After a short service, which reminded me a little of some of the Methodist churches into which I had strayed in my quest for spiritual comfort a few years before, a young man stood up on the platform. Absolute silence pervaded the audience. The young man, I never forget him, had a pale, solemn face, with large, earnest, protuberant blue eyes. He was rather fat, yet anemic looking. I didn't like him at all, but I watched, fascinated, while he stood quietly on the platform. He closed his eyes, passed his hand over his forehead two or three times, and then, to my amazement, a child's shrill treble voice came from his lips. His whole demeanor changed. The fat, ponderous young man became a vivacious, pert little girl of apparently 7 or 8 years old, with a strong foreign accent. I thought it was some new and attractive entertainment of what had really happened, that is, that he had become controlled by a discarnate spirit. I had not the faintest idea. He then proceeded to pick out various people in the audience and gave minute 15 descriptions of other people, their faces, forms, characters, etc. Whatever he said, their person addressed seemed to answer only in one way, with only one word, yes, or that is correct. This went on for about an hour, detailed description by the young men with the little girl's voice, and an affirmative, yes, always from the listener. Towards the end it began to pall on me. The amusement I had felt at hearing the child's piping voice through the man's lips died away, and I was left with a sense of disappointment. A hymn or two, a prayer, and there. Meeting closed. I went home wondering why I had taken so much trouble to go and visit a place about which I knew nothing, and had found to be rather dull and boring. These feelings persisted till about the following Tuesday, when I began to feel a recurring interest in their Thursday meetings. I had a curious feeling, as if my thoughts were being drawn by, or directed to, the place. I forgot my previous boredom, and secretly made arrangements to attend the service. Thursday evening came, and on my way to the place I felt again the exhilaration and interest that I had experienced the previous week, before and at the commencement of the meeting. Down the same dreary passage, up the same drab stairs, the same rather uninteresting, obviously respectable people, the prayers and hymns, but instead of the plump young man, a slim, delicate-looking middle-aged woman, with a mild expression, stood up on the platform. She, too, closed her eyes, rubbed her forehead. But she lurched violently several times. Then, to my delight, she gave a tremendous howl, quite a blood-curdling howl, and after violently swinging her arms in a wild circle round her, narrowly missing the chairman and other officials on the platform, a strong, deep man's voice broke through her lips, speaking at first in some unknown language, then relapsing into broken English. From the books dealing with adventures in the Wild West, Buffalo Bill and others, I gathered that the woman was acting most perfectly, I thought, the part of a North American Indian. I hoped she would do something really exciting and desperate, but to my disappointment she calmed down and adopted the same rather boring procedure of the previous Thursday's performance, namely, one description after another, one detail after another, of quite ordinary, but imaginary, as I thought in my ignorance, people. Everybody said, yes, yes, and that's correct, just as on their previous occasion, until the speaker addressed an elderly bearded man. She gave him the description of a young woman. To my surprise, instead of answering yes, he promptly said, no, I don't recognize her. The speaker went on with more details, to all of which, the man still said no. I thought to myself, old idiot, he doesn't know the rules of the game. Perhaps it would be kind to lean over and whisper to him, you must say yes, just as I was 16. Contemplating doing this, the woman suddenly broke away from the description she was giving and said, still addressing the elderly man, "Oh, now I see another form, there. Form of an older woman." Here followed a description, with many details of personality, which the elderly man at once responded to, saying, "That is my dear wife, she died last year, and now I remember who the first spirit is. It is my wife's younger sister who died several years previously." Then he received some messages and words of love, too, which he replied, "Give her my love, and tell her I am only waiting, quite happily and patiently, till my time comes and I can join her." Remember, readers, that this was the first time during the services that anybody in their audience had answered, or made any comment upon the descriptions and messages. So far it had all been very one-sided, but now the truth burst upon me. It was as if a great light suddenly broke all over me. "Why," I said to myself, "they are speaking of dead people. They are asserting that these dead people are living, and are happy, and clean, and healthy, not rotting in a horrible grave, as I have believed. Oh, joy! Now I know the reason that I was drawn to this place. Sitting in the cheap wooden chair in that poor shabby room, I felt reassurance and peace steal over me such as I had never felt before, and perhaps have never exceeded since, maybe because my need was then so great." Then the medium, as I can now call her, turned in my direction, though not looking directly at me. Her whole appearance underwent a change. She shrank and trembled. Waving her hand backwards and forwards in front of her, she said, "There is someone here who was drowned, a young boy. He was so frightened, poor lad, and could not understand why no one attempted to save him. So many people were near him at their time, but no one tried to save him. Oh, he is moving near to the person to whom he wishes to speak. It is to you, the young girl there, you. He wants you. His name is Charlie, and he is related to you, though you did not know him intimately." She pointed straight at me. I at once recognized the description as being that of my cousin, Charlie, who was drowned bathing, being seized with cramp in his legs, and in full sight of his friends who didn't know anything was wrong with him, as he was a powerful swimmer for his age. All these details were given correctly, and many other matters mentioned in connection with my family. The medium went on to say that I had guides who were looking after me, and that I was being prepared for a special work, similar to that which she, the speaker, was doing, but that I should have great difficulty in doing it, and would have much trial and trouble before I should be ready for the work. This part of the message did not impress me at the time, as I had not the faintest idea how it would ever be possible for me to develop such powers, even if I possessed the nucleus of them, but the general effect of the message was remarkably comforting, the realization that those who died never were in the grave at all, only their cast-off, no longer needed, outer coverings were put below ground, and their real selves, in new healthy bodies, escaped, and soared away to a better land. 17. I traveled home on air. Everything seemed different. Help was in the very breath I drew. I reached home, and immediately made a fatal mistake. Instead of going quietly upstairs to my room, our vestibule door was hardly ever locked, without anybody knowing I had been out, I went straight into the dining room, and waited impatiently for my mother's return. I felt I must share my glorious knowledge with everybody. What a help it would be to mother, who had had so much trouble and anxiety, such a struggle for existence during these last miserable years, when I told her that our trials were known to loving and sympathetic people who had passed over, and who were only waiting for us to open ourselves to them, hold out our hands that they might take them with pity and understanding, ready to help us in whatever way was the best and right one. Mother came in. I began telling her, it all poured out in a torrent. Perhaps I was too impetuous, eager. I dare say I was flustered and excited. Her expression, from being annoyed and startled, settled to one of repressed, but deep, anger, heightened by, I could see it so plainly, fear. Stop, she said, in a quiet but terrifying voice. All you are telling me is vile and wicked, and I forbid you ever to go to that place again. Or do anything further in the matter. It is dreadful. You will have some terrible thing happen to you if you follow such evil practices. They are evil, I tell you, evil. More to the same effect, over and over again. All next day, and the next, until my powers of resistance were worn out. The worst of it was that we had no friends who could in any way help me, or who would have cared to try to alter mother's views. In those days the prejudice against spiritualism was very great. So just as I was forced years before to put away their memory of the Happy Valley visions, so was I now forced to give up the meetings, and any plan or idea of following up the subject which had seemed to offer such interest and peace to me. Yet something of it persisted in me, like a still small voice, reminding me that someday I might be a free agent and able to follow it all up again. Page 18. Chapter 5, Trouble Brewing. As I grew up, we discovered I had a good singing voice, and for several years I trained with the object of becoming a professional singer. I was just about to enter into an engagement for operatic work, when I was taken ill with diphtheria and conveyed to a fever hospital. One of the nurses there was a spiritualist. After I left the hospital, she invited me to her home, where I took part in my first table séance. In case some of you do not know how a table sitting is conducted, I must explain that a code is arranged by which the communicator in the spirit world can spell out messages by tilting the table or rapping on it to each letter of the alphabet. At this sitting I was told that I would one day be a medium, and that I was contributing quite a great amount of power for the sitting that evening. Some very evidential messages were given to me referring to people and matters known to me but not known to the others at the table, and I went away wondering whether there was a possibility of my recovering the faculty of seeing the beautiful scenes I saw when a child. On my return I mustered up my courage and told my mother all that had happened at the nurse's home. She was horrified, and again began telling me of the awful fate that would befall me if I dabbled in such things. I would, so she informed me, be driven either to drugs, drink, or madness, or perhaps all these things combined. My sense of humor made me think, and remark, that as we were always in a state of hard upness, I was unlikely to afford either opium, or morphia, or drink, and that up to the present I had shown no signs of insanity, and didn't see why a subject that helped me to be happy should make me mad. I am afraid I was rather impertinent, but I was grown up now, no longer a child, and I determined to follow up the subject of spiritualism as well as I could. About this time I discovered I was losing my voice owing to the diphtheria and throat complications following it. I began to attend several public meetings for clairvoyance, and sometimes received messages telling me I should develop psychic power. My mother's health became bad, but as she was an active woman I had no idea that it was really serious. 19. One day, December 18, 1906, I went to stay the night at a town 30 miles from our home. In the night I awoke suddenly with a feeling that something unusual was happening. I looked up and saw in front of me, but about 5 feet above the level of my body, a large, circular patch of light about 4 feet in diameter. In this light I saw my mother. Quite distinctly. Her face looked several years younger than I had seen it a few hours before. A pink flush of health was on her cheeks, her eyes were clear and shining, and a smile of utter happiness was on her lips. She gazed down on me for a moment, seeming to convey to me an intense feeling of relief and a sense of safety and well-being. The vision faded. I was wide awake all the time, quite conscious of my surroundings. I jumped out of bed, struck a match and looked at the clock. It was just a few minutes past 2 a.m. I returned to bed and fell into a deep and dreamless sleep, awakening late the next morning to find a telegram from my brother, saying, "Mother passed away 2 o'clock this morning." I was deeply impressed, and felt convinced that my mother had come to me immediately after leaving her physical body to let me know that she still lived, and that all I had heard from the spiritualists was true, that she was now in a new body, a very real and healthy body like the one she had 20 years before, and that all her sufferings and worries were left behind with her discarded physical envelope. Chapter 6, I pick up important threads. As time went on, my voice did not improve, in fact, it deteriorated. I found it was more and more difficult to control the tongue and pharynx. I could not go from a lower to a higher note without difficulty. Some days it was better, others worse. I could not depend on it, so I took parts in plays in which I was not called upon to sing. Fortunately, soon after mother's passing, I met my husband, in a strange way, which I will tell you about in a later chapter, and found that at last there was someone who was sympathetic towards spiritualism. He knew nothing about it, but when I told him some of my experiences and ideas in the matter, it appealed to him as being a reasonable belief. And he was almost as glad as I had been to have something definite, in a spiritual sense, to which he could hold. He had been brought up, like myself, in a strictly orthodox household, but on reaching maturity, like too many others, he drifted away from the old beliefs without having anything to put in their place. Now I always believe that we must use our own will power and perception to the best of our ability in order to deal properly with the daily round of life on earth. I would not admit that we are in any sense puppets, or tools, either of the higher guides, or of that mysterious something called fate or destiny. But, looking back on those days about which I am telling you, I can plainly see that somebody or something was certainly directing me, and shaping my way. In later years, my spirit friends have often told me that they were gently guiding me in certain directions, but as they are never allowed to force or coerce anybody, but only help them to choose the best path, I very often consciously delayed events by doing something that was at variance with their plans. Though at that time I knew nothing definite about my guides, I began to feel strongly impressed that I must find ways and means to investigate spiritualism further, but how to do it I did not know, as about this time my husband's health began to give us some anxiety, and it particularly affected his throat, which, for an actor, was most unfortunate. I knew that there would be no possibility of carrying out my desire to know more of their other side if we went on tour and moved about from one place to another each week. And I felt that the only chance for me to study the subject was for us to stay in or near London in the hope of meeting people who were also interested in it. It was extremely difficult to do this. We experienced great privations and hardships, none of which I regret now, as we learned so much about the terrible struggle that thousands of who would work, and can't, because there seem to be too many people for whatever work is available. One winter we accepted a very poor engagement with a theatrical company that was visiting the suburban theaters. My husband was averse to taking the engagement, it was so badly paid, we could scarcely exist on it, but I felt strongly impressed that it was a good thing to do. 21. During rehearsals my attention was drawn to two young ladies who, I afterwards learned, were sisters, and though I found no opportunity of speaking to them for several days, I found myself continually wishing that I might do so. They, too, looked at me, as if they were just as interested in me as I was in them. No opportunity came until the first performance, which was a matinee. I found that a dressing room had been allocated to the three of us, the two sisters and myself. I went down to the theatre very early, and found the sisters were already there, arranging their dresses and makeup. As soon as I entered the room, which was ugly and bare, a huge place, in a large old-fashioned theatre, I became aware of a most friendly and congenial atmosphere. It was as if that dusty uninviting room were filled with light and warmth. I said, "Good afternoon," the first words I had spoken to them. "Good afternoon," said the elder sister, turning from her unpacking and taking a few steps deliberately towards me. "Are you interested in spiritualism?" I gasped, pulled myself together, and said simply, "Yes, are you?" "Yes, shall we try and experiment together? You, and my sister and I?" "Yes," I replied, feeling as if I were in a dream, speaking and moving automatically, half realizing that something of great importance to my future was taking place, but having no idea how important it was. "Right. We'll try this evening, during the long wait in Act 3. "Right," I said. It was this conversation, just as terse and few-worded as I have recorded here, that was the commencement of everything that happened after, and if, through my late mediumship, any bereaved soul was helped, and I think I can say, quite humbly, that many have been, it all dates back to this extraordinary meeting, and those few bald words that we literally fired at each other that momentous afternoon. Between the matinee and evening performance we had tea together, and talked like people who have known each other all their lives, though I afterwards found out that their sisters were usually very reticent and reserved. They told me they had been interested in this subject through a friend, from whom they had been parted for some time. Their mother had died about the same time as mine, and they had a great desire to communicate with her, and try to find out what truth lay behind spiritualism. They had been waiting to meet somebody with whom they could investigate, just as I had. They, I will call them Florence and Nelly, suggested that we should begin by sitting round a small table, as their psychic friend had told them how to do this, and I also had heard that one experience at the nurse's house, after I left the fever hospital. My husband procured a small table for us, and during the evening, when the hour's interval came, we solemnly and expectantly drew our chairs round it, and placing our hands on the table awaited events. Nothing happened. The next evening we sat again. Chapter 7, My First Meeting with Fader. Still nothing happened. The table behaved like any ordinary table usually does, remaining stationary and lifeless. Undaunted, we sat 26 times, always in their evening, but with no result. On the 27th evening Nelly became discouraged and refused to sit. She said, "There's nothing in it. It's evident that tables don't move unless somebody moves them." She took a book and sat down at the other end of the room by herself. Florence and I still stuck to it, and within 2 minutes the table began to tilt up and down. Overjoyed, I explained how the alphabet was used, and soon Florence's mother and mine were. Spelling out evidential messages. Nayai begged to be allowed to come back. Permission was given and her return made.